This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Yesterday marked the 25th anniversary of the accident at Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine. That anniversary comes as experts try to contain the damage at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant in the wake of the earthquake and tsunami. Of course, all of this brings attention to the potential dangers of nuclear energy, but many experts say that fears over a potential nuclear plant disaster in the U.S. are unfounded. Still, public perception of nuclear safety shifts in the wake of crises like Fukushima or Chernobyl. And public reaction to nuclear technology can have a significant effect on the financial stability of the nuclear industry. So today we're going to take a look at the future of nuclear, the financial costs, the health risk, the environmental benefits, and the dangers of that technology. And joining me now is David McNellis. He's research professor of environmental sciences and engineering at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. David, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
In fact, yesterday you moderated a webinar on the Chernobyl disaster and its relevance to today's industry. Its relevance, is it relevant?
The Chernobyl incident is really not relevant from an accident or from the safety of the plants in the United States. It is relevant from the study or with respect to the study of the health effects, human health effects of low doses of radiation, as is Daiichi. And the one word I would take exception to is Chernobyl was not an accident. It was a consequence of poor management, poor operations, and poor design.
Now, let's take a look at the design of that first. I mean, one of the things, how is it different from Fukushima, for instance?
Well, one of the first things you would look at is that it has no containment. We have 4 to 5 or 5.5 feet thick concrete containment vessel around all of our reactors, and most all of them around the world, except this one particular type, the RBMK that was used in Russia. There's still about a dozen of those left, but they have been re-instrumented so the same thing can happen. And the reason I say it was not an accident, one of the primary reasons, is it was really an experiment that they were conducting, which was unauthorized, unapproved, faulty design of an experiment, and very poorly executed.
The plant itself was an experiment or an experiment?
No, the operators decided they were going to do an experiment.
And what was that?
The experiment was they wanted to there's a lapse in time if the reactor goes down for some reason for an outage before the emergency backup power can come up. And that when the diesel generators come up, it takes several seconds for them to come up to full power. So they wanted to see if they cut off the reactor, how long the turbine and the generator would produce power and whether that would make up the difference. So when Chernobyl actually, when the accident took place, they had made a whole series of mistakes. They had taken out the control rods. They had shut off the recirculating water so that the reactor heated up. And when it started to heat up, it went to 100% of power and it kept on going. And at the time that it actually blew, it was at about 500 atmospheres. So it was not a nuclear explosion. It was basically a boiler that blew up and blew. But unfortunately, when it blew up, it blew about 5% of the core all over the countryside, out to beyond 50 miles.
Now, you said we can learn things about low-level radiation exposure. What did we learn from that?
We're still learning. We had some very high exposures because there were 139 people on site when that happened, and 28 of them were in the first to die from the Chernobyl incident. We are still, there's several hundred thousand of these workers that went in to do limited amounts of work for a few seconds at a time in order to get that under control. And those people are being followed now in terms of health effects associated with them. So far, as we talked about earlier, there were at the end of 2005, there were about 50 deaths attributed to Chernobyl. And over the next several decades, up to 4,000 people, statistically up to 4,000 people, could die prematurely from exposures.
Is there anything we've learned about design or protocol and response? Of course, we know the response was also horrid. The Soviets refused to even acknowledge it. They didn't tell anybody not to drink the milk and all of that sort of thing. And that led to certainly that's something we can learn. What about design and protocol? Anything from that that we have learned and anything that's made its way into the regulations as a result?
Well, the operators deciding to do an experiment is something that can't happen. I mean, it's just an impossibility to take place in our system or elsewhere in the world today. We know the containment at Three Mile Island did work. In terms of protocols, we have a number of people on shift that are one of the things that was lacking is a safety consciousness in the Soviet Union at that time. And there's a very strong safety consciousness around the world with respect to nuclear. Nuclear is perhaps, from an industry standpoint, is the most there's the most oversight of any industry we have.
There's a lot of oversight and sort of a lot of awareness, too, and transparency seems to be the important thing. The fact that the Soviets thought they'd get away with trying to keep a secret is probably what led them to even try. But also, nuclear power, nuclear energy is proprietary. It becomes a security risk. We're not going to let anybody in, nor have we let anybody from the outside in to inspect our plants. Is that a problem when it comes to transparency, the fact that there are proprietary interests in nuclear technology?
We do allow people into the plants, and it changes from plant to plant and utility to utility. But we do have like commissioners from the people in government figures that are in the area around the plant have opportunity to visit the plant. I myself have been in several of the plants in the United States, but they do allow government officials that are in a response mode or a response team to be in the plant.
But not international. We wouldn't allow international. We've never allowed international inspections. I mean, there's an International Atomic Energy Commission, and there are international standards, aren't there?
There are international standards.
But there's no way to be transparent because we're not going to let somebody from another country look at our plant.
I'm not sure whether the IAEA visits our plants or not. They do have oversight, as we've talked about, around the world, and they do develop guidelines and for the plants to operate.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about the future of nuclear energy. David McNellis is with us, research professor of environmental sciences and engineering at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Just ahead, our discussion on the future of nuclear continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today about the future of nuclear energy. Joining us now is John Gilligan, director of the Nuclear Energy University's program of the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy. And Jim Warren is with us, director of NC Warren, a North Carolina environmental advocacy group. John and Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Frank. Good to have you here. And still with us is David McNellis, research professor of environmental sciences and engineering at UNC Chapel Hill. Nuclear power in North Carolina accounts for roughly a third of North Carolina's total power generation. As we see the population grow, we assume energy consumption will as well. Duke Energy is waiting for approval to break ground on the Williams States Lee Nuclear Station in Cherokee County, South Carolina. Construction now held up by additional safety regulations and concerns inspired because of Fukushima in Japan. John, how does the proposed Lee plant differ, if it does at all, from the Fukushima plant?
Well, the Lee plant is a third-generation plant. The Fukushima plant was a first-generation plant designed and built in 1970. So there's been a lot of safety add-on since the original design. And, of course, the Fukushima plant was a BWR, a boiling water reactor. The design for the Lee plant is a PWR, a different manufacturer with added safety features, passive safety, et cetera. So it's certainly a third-generation design with lots of passive safety features that the Fukushima plants did not have.
Jim Warren, safe enough to go in, go up, and provide our electricity?
Well, let me correct one thing. The Lee project is not even scheduled to begin construction for at least a couple of years. They're not being held up by Fukushima. They don't even have a final design for that Westinghouse reactor yet. It hasn't been approved. It's under a legal challenge right now, in fact. But, we don't think that these new designs are as safe as they should be, because most of the safety improvements have been offset by cost-cutting measures. And, you know, the proof is in the fact that the industry has demanded that the public continue to insure these plants against disasters and to finance them and to take all the financial risk for it. And that's what Duke Energy is trying to do in North Carolina. The nuclear revival, even before Fukushima, was in shambles. And those are the words of a former NRC commissioner. And that's because most of the projects around the country have been sidelined because of financial risk and the risk of project cancellation, which happened over 90 times back in the 70s and 80s, or with over 90 reactors.
Yeah, but does that mean that the costs have gone up because our safety concerns have gone up, so we're building in more safety? It's going to cost us more.
No, that's you know, what has happened. The new designs theoretically could be better, but one of the biggest problems is we don't have an independent regulator in this country. I mean, the NRC has been captive of this industry for so long. They've let multiple plants operate in violation of their own safety regulations. But the new designs, you know, the passive cooling theoretically could be better, but it does not account for a collapsed building or a collapsed spent fuel pool and a host of other scenarios. The spent fuel storage, in fact, is a perfect example of how the industry has tried to cut cost out of these price tags by reverting back to high-density storage of spent fuel, exactly what the National Academy of Sciences in 2005 warned against. So they've cut costs to try to get some utilities to attempt to build them.
Well, all right, let's talk about that. Let's talk about spent fuel, John.
Spent fuel, it's a good topic. We've been storing spent fuel here at, for instance, the Sharon Harris plant for over 25 years with no problems whatsoever. It's separately governed by the NRC. There's separate regulations for spent fuel storage on site, separately governed by the NRC. And I would disagree that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is independent, completely independent of the industry and Department of Energy as well, in terms of how it regulates nuclear energy in this country. Very effective. It's a world leader, recognized as such. Certainly, there are incidences that are reported and taken care of. All of these have been very minor. Since Three Mile Island in this country, it hasn't been an accident of any size in 30 years. And the nuclear industry is exemplary in terms of its operations. I would also say that the AP1000 reactor that has been proposed by Westinghouse for the Lee complex is already being built at the Vogtle plant by Southern States, by Southern Company in Georgia right now. That's moving ahead, as well as the Summer plant in South Carolina. So as soon as the NRC has final approval on that, those processes, the money's been raised to a large extent. Those are moving ground right now, and we'll have much operating and construction experience along the way as those projects are completed. So I think along with the TVA plant that's being completed now in the United States, I think it's clear that there will be some slowdown, no doubt, as a result of reexamining some of the regulations and the licensing procedures. The NRC is doing that right now, both with a 60-day or a 90-day and a review, as well as a six-month review. As soon as those are completed, that these projects will move ahead. The NRC is very much like the FDA. It's a completely separate agency that looks at the regulation of nuclear power in particular. It's been very effective, and I have every confidence in the world from what I've seen over the years that they do an excellent job.
Well, let's just say, based on the record, Jim, that there has not been a serious incident with nuclear power in this country. If that's the test of the NRC, then they're doing pretty well?
You've got reactors at least several dozen sites contaminating groundwater. You've got plants. NRC admits that scores of plants have been in noncompliance with fire protection regulations for at least two decades. That's the leading risk factor for a meltdown. The lack of a meltdown in this time is no threshold by which to judge the safety. But yeah, I wanted to touch briefly on the fact that, look, the biggest reason that we have to turn away from trying to build new nuclear plants is climate change. Nuclear is a lower carbon technology, I give them that, but it is so hugely expensive and uncertain that it is squandering our chances, trying to build them is squandering our chances to avert worsening climate change. And we know how to phase out the coal plants in North Carolina. We can do that through energy efficiency, through renewables that are coming on strong in free markets all over the world, and through cogeneration. We don't need to be gambling so much time and money on new nuclear. We need to be doing what we can to make the shift, the inevitable shift that humanity is moving toward. But in North Carolina, the utilities are blocking the way with these clean technologies so they can preserve their chances to try to build these huge $10 billion reactors.
Is it a transition technology, do you think, Jim? I mean, the fact is that coal-fired electricity costs thousands of lives, thousands of premature deaths every year. That's not a risk. It's a certainty. Yes. Thousands of people die because of the way we generate electricity. We don't yet have the power, the capacity technically to go to renewables. Should we take nuclear in the meantime because it kills fewer people?
Actually, we do have the capacity now. That the top federal energy regulator, John Wellingoff, is supportive of this idea of using solar and wind in combination, which can approach what is now called baseload power. But look, nuclear is such an uncertainty. Duke Energy's project now is a 17-year project. And that's even if they stay on time schedule from this point forward, which is a huge uncertainty. We simply cannot gamble our marbles going in the nuclear direction.
Is it too costly? John, you were about to respond to that, so go ahead.
I think that's a good point, and I would like to bring up the fact also that in the region of Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, it's actually about 40% nuclear right now, and we have some of the lowest rates in the country for electricity. So I think the fact that the plants that were built back in the 70s, 80s in this region have operated extremely well. They're extremely well managed. High capacity factor, getting better. They paid for themselves many times over, and it's clear the record associated with nuclear, as far as the cost goes, is clear. I think it's also true that any investment that we have in new energy source for this country is going to cost a lot of money, whether it's nuclear, carbon sequestrated coal, natural gas in terms of the peaking units that we're interested in, and renewables, wind and solar certainly are important. But the reason they haven't broken the marketplace is because of the cost and the transmission lines that are going to be necessary to take the power from one location to another where those sources are more plentiful. Also, the storage factor. We don't want to confuse renewables that are intermittent with base load nuclear capability or coal capability or natural gas capability. I think they're really two different animals that you have to examine.
But you talked about the market not being ready or the not wanting to embrace it because there are these expensive technical problems with renewables. The market does not embrace nuclear. Wall Street won't touch it, and that's why I believe Duke Energy would like to increase our rates so that they can bear the cost of building these new plants. In other words, they're putting the risk on customers. Does that mean that the market doesn't want nuclear either?
No, I don't think so, Frank. I think the recession has hit everything. In the last 2 to 3 years, the electric production in this country has actually decreased. So from all sources. So the need for electric power has been on a decline. That's the reason that I think the power companies are not moving ahead with new generation of any kind. It has nothing to do with the ultimate cost of one versus the other. They're all costly. I would certainly hope, and our ratepayers would be attuned to the fact that the utilities are not going to invest in anything that's not going to be in the long term cheaper than some other form. They don't have any attachment to nuclear more than they would coal or the renewables. If something's going to perform, that's what they're going to go with.
Renewables are dominating free markets in this country and in many parts of the world, dominating. And even Duke Energy is investing heavily in wind and solar, but they're not doing it in these monopoly states where they are allowed to have captive customer bases that they can force to pre-charge for nuclear power plants and take all the risk for their look. Climate change is so severe that I tell you, despite my many years of looking at this nuclear industry quite closely, if nuclear could help with climate change, I would be out there demanding that we build these nuclear plants. But our time is running out on climate change, and we simply do not have the decades and the billions of dollars to gamble in the nuclear direction. If we could gamble that and not get anything for it. So we, you know, the technology, solar and wind, North Carolina leads the East Coast in offshore wind capacity. Duke Energy Progress ought to be out there gobbling it up and dominating that too. We need to have distributed solar around the state. We don't, you know, it's not about huge central power plants anymore. And we have to have more democratic decision making and take the money out of the politics and take the industry's money out of the equation that's polluting the process.
What about that, John? Are we really making the choice? Are we really entering into that choice in a democratic way? Or is there a way that the market dominance has skewed the picture?
Well, I think in North Carolina, we do have a renewable portfolio standard and targets. So I think the democratic process has worked, and that's law in this state. So we will see renewables at certain levels integrated into our rate base sooner or later. There's targets that are published out there. But I would also point out that nuclear generates in this country now 70% of the carbon-free electricity. And over the last 20 years, nuclear, the increase in the efficiencies of nuclear plants coupled with the higher capacity factors have outstripped renewable production towards that fact, clearly by a factor of four. In other words, the improvement in the operations of the nuclear plants has created much more carbon-free energy without building any nuclear power plants than renewables altogether, even though they're growing too. And that's a good thing. I'm not saying that renewables are a bad thing. I think we need to have a mix of renewables in the process, but they're intermittent sources. They don't load follow. They're not base load generation, and if you don't have that as your primary base, the system is just not going to work.
Jim, do you see nuclear and renewables going hand in hand in the future with a different kind of balance, or do you see nuclear out of the picture if you were to write the rules?
Well, it's not what I wish. It's what the utilities have set forth. They are blocking advances in energy efficiency, which is the best thing we need to be doing. We're wasting half our energy, but they are blocking efficiency. They're blocking the advances of solar and wind.
How are they doing cogeneration?
How
are they doing
it? Well, they're using basically the legislation that John mentioned as PR cover so they can build nuclear plants. The requirement for solar in this state is 0.2%. And the utilities have made it quite clear that they are capping it at that. Their PR is one thing, but their long-term forecast, their official documents show that by 2030, Duke Energy plans to have almost zero energy efficiency, almost no solar and no wind energy at all. So their PR is one thing, but they believe apparently they can't make money off clean energy technology. So, and they know that if we get energy efficient in this state, it further undermines the argument for building nukes. So they believe they have to keep impeding our advances.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today, talking about the future of nuclear energy with John Gilligan, director of the U.S. Department of Energy's Nuclear Energy University Program, and Jim Warren is director of NC Warren, a North Carolina environmental advocacy group. Just ahead, the firsthand account of how two nuclear bombs fell on North Carolina 50 years ago. That story after the break. Stay tuned.